Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.12, The Bulgarian National Revival, Bulgarian Liberation, Part 1. Last time, we took stock of the international situation surrounding the declining Ottoman Empire, as the great powers of Europe were becoming increasingly anxious about what would happen if the Ottoman dynasty were to truly collapse. As we saw, these worries mainly centered around Russian expansion at Ottoman expense, and the desires of the British and French to halt this expansion. This diplomatic quandary is what has historically been dubbed the Eastern Question, and as we saw, it ultimately led the fragile post-Napoleonic peace to finally blow up in everyone's faces with the outbreak of the Crimean War. This rather large conflict ended with the Ottomans gaining a rare victory against the Russians. However, this victory was mainly due to French and British support, and the Ottomans thereafter became ever more indebted to Britain and France, and therefore ever more beholden to their desires. Then, we also discussed the simultaneous efforts of Ottoman reformers to modernize the empire with the onset of the Tanzimat era, in which Ottoman leaders sought to create a modernized and unified Ottoman nation in which all citizens would at least nominally enjoy equal rights within a more efficient and prosperous empire. These two intertwined developments, the Eastern Question and the efforts of Tanzimat reformers, will act as the motor whirring in the background, driving the course of future events within the Ottoman Empire as the 19th century comes to a close. So, after these last few episodes, hopefully you now have a better understanding of what's been going on in the wider international scene. And since we are now all caught up on the big picture, that means that today we get to start another mini-series as we do a deep dive into the dramatic events that will culminate with the liberation of Bulgaria. As we will see, the revolutionary activities of the Bulgarians will ultimately precipitate yet another explosive international crisis, the so-called Great Eastern Crisis, that will once again bring the Ottoman Empire to the brink of collapse. So yep, that's right, we've got another crisis to look forward to. And if you can believe it, the Great Eastern Crisis is really the mother of all crises for the Ottomans who, as we know, have seen quite a few international crises in their day. So, over the next several episodes, we will be covering the Bulgarian struggle for independence, similarly to what we did with the Greeks, with the Great Eastern Crisis acting as the climax of this miniseries and the climax of part one of this season. But one thing to keep in mind here is that this period of the late 19th century will witness widespread revolutionary activity not just in Bulgaria, but throughout the entirety of the Balkans. And all of these events are deeply intertwined. So even though Bulgaria will act as the anchor point for our narrative over the next several episodes, we will still be touching upon events in Serbia, Romania, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Greece, and Constantinople. So with that said, let's dive into the liberation of Bulgaria. Now, we haven't talked all that much about Bulgaria yet, as we put most of our attention towards the Serbs and the Greeks when we looked at earlier revolutionary events in the Balkans. And you honestly probably don't remember this, but the last time we ran into the Bulgarians was way back in episode 1.2 on the Serbian Revolution, when we discussed the rising power of Pashvanoglu Osman, the rebellious pasha who grew his power base around the city of Vidin in northwestern Bulgaria. Well, since the days when Pashvanoglu was terrorizing and overtaxing the Bulgarian peasantry, Bulgaria had actually witnessed some positive reforms as the Tanzimat leaders would pay special attention to reforming Bulgaria specifically. Now, they did this for a couple of reasons. First, the region served as an important source of natural resources for the empire, and this importance was becoming ever more important as the Ottomans lost more and more of their domains to the combined forces of revolutionary nationalism and European imperialism. And secondly, Bulgaria is just much closer to Constantinople than other areas of the Balkans. If you check out the map at 20thcenturyrevolutions.com, you'll see what I'm talking about. Bulgaria is just barely northwest of the Ottoman imperial capital, which meant, more than anything else, that if the Russians wanted to march on Constantinople, they would have to come through Bulgaria. you know, if the Russians ever wanted to march on Constantinople. Foreshadow alert. So the simple geographic importance of Bulgaria within the empire had long been and will continue to be a very important factor in the future course of events there. And because of its strategic position, Ottoman leaders had historically sought to assert more centralized control in Bulgaria than in other majority Christian lands of the Balkans. So with this special interest in mind, reforms in Bulgaria did begin to see some real success following the Crimean War, mainly due to the leadership of a man who's going to be coming in and out of our story a good bit, and who is really the last great reformer of the Tanzimat generation. So we might as well introduce Midhat Pasha, who will, in 1876, promulgate the first and only constitution for the Ottoman Empire, but who, in the mid-1860s, was making a name for himself as an extremely capable administrator in Ottoman Bulgaria. Midhat Pasha was an idealistic yet practical reformer who strongly believed that the best way to do away with separatism and nationalism in the empire was to introduce positive reforms and to show the people the benefits of good government. In 1864, Midhat was put in charge of a new administrative region called the Danube Violet, which covered a good amount of the territory in what would one day become Bulgaria, and which was basically an experimental pet project of the Tanzimat, where the region would be modernized, with the idea being that other regional leaders would follow Midhat's lead and learn from his experience reforming the Danube Violet. As he sought to build his model Tanzimat province in Bulgaria, Midhat constructed new roads and bridges and tunnels, he introduced steamship lines along the Danube, he created a cooperative bank that gave out friendly loans to the peasantry, he built new schools, orphanages, and hospitals, and he even founded a newspaper which would trumpet the benefits of signing on to his new regime. And a lot of these efforts are still visible in Bulgaria today, as many of these schools and hospitals and bridges are still up and running. And Midhat was also a leading supporter of Ottomanism, which, as we saw last episode, sought to create a unified Ottoman nation made up of equal citizens. So in an effort to foster equality, Midhat invited a handful of Christian leaders to participate in his government, though it is important to note that most of these Christian leaders were not actual Bulgarians, but were foreigners who had been brought in. Midhat even tried to integrate schools in Bulgaria by establishing secular institutions with both Muslim and non-Muslim students. However, this secularization of schooling was wildly unpopular amongst both Christians and Muslims alike, and the policy was quickly abandoned. Midhat's reforms of the 1860s began to raise the standard of living in Bulgaria, and during his tenure, he would boost the revenue of the region to nearly 10 times that of when he arrived, and he also greatly increased literacy and education amongst Bulgarians. Though, as forward-looking leaders so often do, Midhat coupled these positive reforms with fierce suppression of Bulgarian freedom fighters. So Midhat really did improve the lives of everyday Bulgarians in many ways, but his regime was not so great for those who dreamed of Bulgarian independence or autonomy. Initially, this carrot-and-stick method of positive reforms coupled with fierce repression did help check the power of regional warlords in the tradition of Pashvanoglu, and generally suppressed rebellious elements in Bulgaria, as was intended. However, these improvements also had some unintended consequences as there began to form a new middle class in Bulgaria, made up of people who were more educated and more wealthy, which, okay, but as this middle class grew, many of them would prove to be ever more politically radical. Specifically, a Bulgarian nationalist movement began to emerge as people became more and more interested in their shared national heritage as Bulgarians. And so, without exactly meaning to, Midhat would help to accelerate what is often called the Bulgarian National Revival, or the Bulgarian National Awakening. The Bulgarian Revival was essentially a cultural and artistic movement in which more and more Bulgarians were becoming more and more interested in Bulgarian history, culture, and identity. Now, the Bulgarian revival has some deep roots, reaching all the way back to the mid-1700s. But it was quite small for quite a long time, and it was always limited to a pretty tiny percentage of the overall population, as the vast majority of Bulgarians were rural peasants who could not read or write, and they would probably not even know what you were talking about if you called them a Bulgarian. As we saw in Greece, many peasants living in the Balkans at this time did not necessarily attach to a nationality or ethnic heritage in any way we would recognize today. And many peasants in Bulgaria actually called themselves Romans, much like their neighbors over in Greece, which did not mean that they had any sort of allegiance whatsoever to the recently established Greek nation. But rather, it meant that most peasants in Bulgaria most identified with the patriarchate of the Greek Orthodox Church. And in fact, one interesting thing about Bulgarian nationalism early on is that for the majority of Bulgarians, i.e. Bulgarian peasants, the church would be the arena through which Bulgarian identity would first be developed. Because, beginning in the 1850s, Bulgarian religious leaders would become increasingly dissatisfied with the Orthodox Patriarchate, whose leadership had long been dominated by Phanariot Greeks. Now, you may remember that many of the leaders of the Filiki Etairia, who first launched the Greek Revolution, came from this elite aristocratic class of Phanariot Greeks. Well, the Phanariot Greeks who took part in the revolution were only a small segment of this community, and many, many Phanariot Greeks continued to live in and support the Ottoman Empire. And this was because they were one of the most influential and prosperous groups in Constantinople, and a big reason for their prosperity was their historic influence over the Patriarchate of the Orthodox Church. Now, last week we introduced the Ottoman millet system, the administrative division of the empire into ethno-religious groups. But one interesting thing is that at this point in the mid-19th century, Orthodox Bulgarians were still lumped into the same millet as Orthodox Greeks. But after the revolutions in Serbia and Greece made nationalism a thing, Bulgarian church officials began to chafe under the enduring stranglehold that Greeks held over the Orthodox leadership. Throughout the 1850s and 1860s, there would be an ongoing struggle between the Greek and Bulgarian sections of the Orthodox Church, as Bulgarians pressed for more autonomy within the Patriarchate. And an integral part of this struggle was teaching everyday Bulgarians about their shared national heritage, in order to forge ethnic solidarity amongst Bulgarians as Bulgarians. So even though the identity of Bulgarian peasants had long been most associated with Greek Orthodoxy, this began to change in the 1850s and 1860s as religious leaders, who held a ton of clout within their communities, began to push the idea of a Bulgarian Orthodox identity, separate from that of the Greek Orthodox identity. So, in the mid-19th century, Bulgarian nationalism was beginning to sprout up in a few different ways as Bulgarian church officials were pressing for increased autonomy within the Patriarchate, and as economic growth under Midhat Pasha's Tanzimat reforms was leading to an expansion of an educated middle class. The Bulgarian population was becoming more interested than ever in their shared national heritage, and as a result, the Bulgarian revival began to pick up major momentum. But there would be a difference in approach between these two groups of the Bulgarian revival, as church officials would tend to seek autonomy through more official channels, and would often appeal to Ottoman officials to help them in their struggle against the leadership of the Greek Orthodox Church. But the nationalists coming out of this growing middle class tended to be more secular in their beliefs and increasingly more radical in their approach. And as was happening in other places in Europe, such as Germany and Italy, academic and artistic interest in national history and folklore were becoming subtle ways to express revolutionary nationalism without risking exile and arrest. And many of the later figures of the Bulgarian revival would appear on the surface to just simply be interested in Bulgarian history as an intellectual pursuit. But they were in actuality closeted revolutionaries actively planning how best to overthrow the Ottomans. The first figure to really combine this interest in Bulgarian culture and history with direct revolutionary action was Georgi Rakovsky, who, along with being one of the most famous figures of the late Bulgarian Revival, is also the great precursor of the Bulgarian Revolutionary Movement, as Rakovsky was about 20 to 30 years older than most of the other major figures within the Bulgarian liberation struggle. So he's like the cool uncle of the movement, as many future revolutionary leaders will become inspired by Rakovsky's writings and seek him out as a mentor early in their lives. As an activist, writer, newspaper editor, poet, historian, and revolutionary organizer, the career of Georgi Rakovsky was perhaps most defined by his insane work ethic. I mean, when you read about all the things he did, it's not clear that the dude ever went to sleep, as he was always up to something, whether it be churning out revolutionary literary works, speaking with national leaders to gain support for the Bulgarian cause, forming revolutionary cells, establishing Freemason lodges, setting up radical newspapers, or leading small guerrilla bands in attacks against the Ottoman authorities. So yeah, Rakovsky accomplished quite a lot in his life, and his obsessive, almost monomaniacal drive to liberate his people was very important for the Bulgarian revolutionary movement early on. Like many young Bulgarians with a promising intellectual curiosity, Rakovsky began his education at a local monastery before being sent off to Constantinople to attend the Fanar Greek Orthodox College, which is the oldest and most prestigious Orthodox school in Istanbul, established way back in 1454, just after the Ottomans took Constantinople, and it remains a prestigious school to this day. Over the years, the school will become a center of Fanariot Greek life in Constantinople, and while attending the school, the young Rakovsky would become involved in the early struggle to establish autonomy for Bulgarians within the Orthodox Church. But Rakovsky quickly began to adopt some pretty different tactics than his mentors amongst the Bulgarian church leadership, as he would in 1841, at the ripe young age of 20, help to establish his very first secret revolutionary society, whose goal was the liberation of Bulgaria. And this will become a real pastime for Rakovsky, as he will establish secret societies for the liberation of Bulgaria basically everywhere he goes. But this first society would quickly be disbanded when the Ottoman authorities uncovered a plot to launch a revolt, and Rakovsky, as the ringleader, would actually be sentenced to death. But since Rakovsky had some good connections within the powerful Fanariot Greek community, having attended their prestigious school, his sentence was changed to mere exile to France. After living in Marseille for a couple years, Rakovsky would sneak on back to his hometown in Bulgaria, working for a while as a lawyer and a merchant. And it was during this time that Rakovsky began to write literature, a pursuit that he would continue for the rest of his life. Then, things began to change for Rakovsky with the outbreak of the Crimean War. When Rakovsky got word of this new war with Russia, he began putting together another secret society, which hoped to use the war to further the cause of Bulgarian liberation. And then, somehow, these guys were able to land jobs as interpreters for the Ottoman military, being stationed along the Danube River on the present-day Romanian-Bulgarian border, where a lot of the early fighting happened. And then, Rakovsky and his little band of Bulgarian nationalists did what any sane person might have expected them to do. Rather than help the Ottomans to fight the Russians, Rakovsky instead secretly launched a small pro-Russian rebellion in Bulgaria in hopes that the Tsar would return the favor and offer support for Bulgarian independence. And this was not some crazy far-fetched plan, as part of the Russian strategy during this campaign was to try and whip up anti-Ottoman revolts amongst Bulgarians and Serbs. But even so, Rakovsky's itty-bitty rebellion was quickly swatted away, and then the Crimean War shifted from the Balkans to being fought around the Black Sea. After this little stunt, Rakovsky was arrested by Ottoman authorities and once again sentenced to death. But since he couldn't really use his good connections to dodge two death sentences, he instead had to escape, and he would then go into hiding. And from this point on, Rakovsky was more or less always on the run as a wanted revolutionary, and he would spend his time in exile doing what Rakovsky did best, cranking out revolutionary literature and forming secret revolutionary societies basically everywhere he went. It was during this time of early exile, following his little Crimean War stunt, that Rakovsky wrote one of his most famous literary works entitled The Forest Traveler. Written in 1854, but not published until 1857, The Forest Traveler is an epic folk poem about a Bulgarian man who tries to recruit followers to help him fight the Ottomans. So yeah, the poem was kind of just based on Rakovsky's life as a revolutionary agitator. However, an important aspect of the poem is that it centers around the rustic Bulgarian mountain men known as the Hajduk, and Rakovsky's poem would help to popularize and romanticize the Hajduk as noble Bulgarian freedom fighters. The Hajduk are kind of like a Slavic version of the Greek Klephs, as the Hajduks were historically armed bandits and highway robbers. The Hajduk could be found scattered throughout the Balkans, as well as in other areas of Central and Eastern Europe. So, in this way, the Hajduk were not solely an Ottoman phenomenon. But in places under Ottoman rule, like Bulgaria, the Hajduk grew to become Robin Hood-esque characters who would steal from the Ottoman authorities and then give back some of their loot to the Orthodox Christian communities, who would often feed and shelter the Hajduk in return for a share in the spoils. Rakovsky's poem, The Forest Traveler, depicts a band of Hajduks as they fight against Ottoman rule. And the poem contains a bunch of nationalistic themes about the power of a united Bulgarian people. And the main character, the leader of a Hajduk band, spends a ton of time calling upon the people to join him in his struggle to throw off the Ottoman yoke. Notably, within these proclamations, Rakovsky made use of the phrase freedom or death, which he likely translated from the similar phrase used by Greek revolutionaries. And moving forward, freedom or death will become the motto of countless revolutionary organizations across the political spectrum and in many different areas of the Balkans, which points to the widespread influence of Rakovsky's work. With revolutionary slogans and calls for armed rebellion, the poem is pretty transparently a work of anti-Ottoman revolutionary propaganda. And this might help explain why Rakovsky originally wrote the poem in an archaic form of Bulgarian, because, well, this would help it slip through the censors. But this archaic language, of course, also made the work, you know, pretty hard to read, at least for the small percentage of people who could even read in the first place. But even so, the poem would go on to be very influential. Rakovsky's poem is often considered the first literary poem written in Bulgarian, and a ton of the future Bulgarian revolutionaries will similarly dabble in poetry as revolutionary poems became a centerpiece of the Bulgarian national revival. In 1861, Rakovsky would leave his hideout in rural Bulgaria and head for nearby Serbia, where he would begin to put into practice many of the ideas he had been writing about over the past 5 years while in hiding. And now that Rakovsky is over in Serbia, let's catch up on what's been going on with the Serbs. You may remember that Serbia had technically remained under nominal Ottoman suzerainty after the Serbian Revolution. However, by the 1860s, the Principality of Serbia was becoming ever more independent of the Ottomans. Now, you may also remember that the rivalry between Miloš Obrenović and Karađorđe, the two principal leaders of the Serbian Revolution, had left in its wake a dynastic struggle between two competing royal families, Obrenović and Karađorđević, that would last for decades. Well, at this point, Miloš Obrenović's son, Michael Obrenović, had been anointed Prince of Serbia in 1860, this being his second time serving as prince, as he had been deposed 2 decades earlier in 1842 by Karađorđe's son. So, Serbia is now back under the Obrenović dynasty, after having been under the Karađorđević dynasty for 16 years. When Prince Michael Obrenović returned to the Serbian throne, he decided that he wanted to, once and for all, expel the last of the Ottoman military garrisons from Serbia, as he wanted to use this removal of the imperial army to gain further autonomy for the principality. Originally, the light presence of Ottoman troops in Belgrade had been one of the treaty conditions agreed upon when Serbia initially won their autonomy in the Serbian Revolution. However, during and after the Crimean War, the great powers had agreed to allow an increased presence of Ottoman soldiers for security purposes, in part due to the forced migration of Muslim refugees who were fleeing the violent reprisals of the Russian Empire during and after the Crimean War. As you might expect, this increased presence of Ottoman soldiers was taken as an insult by the proud Serbian leaders. So Prince Michael had begun hatching some secret plans to make war against the Ottomans. And so, when the charismatic and always opportunistic Rakovsky arrived in the Serbian capital of Belgrade in 1861, he was able to convince Prince Michael to allow him to create a Bulgarian legion that would join in the effort to drive the Ottomans out of Serbia. And to recruit soldiers for his revolutionary fighting squad, Rakovsky published the now famous Plan for the Liberation of Bulgaria, and the dissemination of this plan led over 500 Bulgarians to flock to Belgrade, many of whom had been living as exiles in Romania. And as we'll see, the journey from Bucharest to Belgrade and back will become a common path for Bulgarian revolutionaries over the coming decade. As tensions rose between Serbia and the Ottomans, the Bulgarian Legion began to receive military training in preparation for a potential conflict. And many of the future heroes of the Bulgarian liberation struggle were members of this initial Bulgarian Legion, including, of course, Rakovsky himself, who led the Legion, but also Vasil Levski, who is arguably the most famous Bulgarian revolutionary of them all, and who we will more properly introduce next week. So many of our future revolutionaries got their first taste of battle within Rakovsky's Legion. Because in 1862, there was an incident in Belgrade in which an Ottoman soldier killed a young Serbian boy during an altercation. This murder led to anti-Ottoman riots breaking out amongst the Serbs of Belgrade. Then, allegedly in an effort to control the chaos, the Ottoman military stationed outside Belgrade began bombarding the city. And during this little riot, the Bulgarian Legion would help to defend the Serbs of Belgrade against the Ottomans. And though this was very light skirmishing, this would give baby revolutionaries like Vasil Levski their first taste of battle. All of this chaos in Belgrade actually led to a minor international incident, and the great powers, yet again, swooped in to handle the situation. This all led to a conference being held in Constantinople, where Prince Michael quite skillfully appealed to the great powers and negotiated a settlement in which it was agreed that all Ottoman Muslims would be forced to leave Serbia. Then, after some more hard bargaining, the Grand Vizier also agreed that Serbian troops would be allowed to replace Ottoman soldiers in the military garrisons, and that these garrisons would be permitted to fly the Serbian flag. So, this offers a nice glimpse into how the great powers at this point were really just dictating terms to the Ottomans. And the Serbs are clearly taking some major steps towards complete independence, because it had just been decided that the entire Turkish population would have to leave Serbia. And this would really begin what would be a long, drawn-out, and bloody process by which Turkish Muslims living in Serbia would be driven from their homes as Serbia became more independent. But for our friends in the Bulgarian Legion under Georgi Rakovsky, as part of the negotiations with the Sultan, it was agreed that the radical Bulgarian Legion would have to be disbanded, and the members of the Legion were exiled from Serbia. So, Rakovsky and many of his comrades were exiled to Romania, and Rakovsky would live the rest of his life as an émigré in Bucharest, capital of the newly united Romanian principality. So now that Rakovsky has made it to Romania, let's talk about Romania. Now, for the entirety of this season, I have been referring to Romania as the Danubian principalities because that's what people called it. But some clarification is now needed. The Danubian principalities actually refers to two different and autonomous political units, Wallachia and Moldavia. Though the histories of these two principalities have long been wrapped up in one another, which points towards why diplomats often refer to Wallachia and Moldavia simply as the Danubian principalities. And as we briefly noted last episode, the principalities had been one of the few places where the nationalistic revolutions of 1848 that erupted all across Europe had infiltrated the Ottoman Empire. This was mainly because the Danubian principalities existed in sort of a different space than Bulgaria and even than Serbia. The on-the-ground experience of Romanians living in Wallachia and Moldavia was at this point less defined by exploitation at the hands of, say, Ottoman tax farmers or religious persecution by Muslim elites, which was the experience of many Bulgarians. Rather, Romanians had over the years become frustrated by the ongoing presence of the Russian Imperial Army and the meddling of Russian diplomats in their politics. So, whereas Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece all historically looked to Russia, their Orthodox benefactor, for aid in their struggle against the Ottomans, the Romanians had already been quote-unquote liberated by the Russians in 1829, in the aftermath of the Greek Revolution. But this liberation really meant the occupation of the principalities by the Russian army. And then, even after the army left, the Russians continued to pull the strings of Romanian politics, always making sure their chosen candidates would hold important positions, with the most important position being the hospodar, or prince, of each principality. So, in 1848, a nationalist revolution in Wallachia successfully dethroned the Russian-backed Wallachian prince, and the revolutionaries then established a provisional government that was actually modeled after the Second French Republic. And the Wallachian Revolution is especially interesting in this way because many of the revolutionary leaders had spent a ton of time in Paris, bumping shoulders with the political radicals there. So that when the February Revolution broke out in France in 1848, several Romanians who were living in Paris at the time actually took part in the revolution and helped the Parisians overthrow our old friend Louis-Philippe, King of the French. And then, after witnessing the establishment of the Second French Republic, several of these Romanian émigrés would head back home to Bucharest and be instrumental in launching the Wallachian Revolution that very same year. So, from the beginning, Romanian revolutionary politics were much more directly influenced by the radicalism of Western Europe centered around Paris. Along with Parisian radicals, the Romanian revolutionaries were also influenced by the Italian revolutionary group, the Carbonari, who had the unification of Italy as one of their main goals. These Romanian nationalists similarly dreamed of uniting the principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia into a single Romanian nation. However, even though the Wallachian Revolution did see early success when they overthrew the Russian-backed prince, things would pretty quickly begin to fall apart when a parallel revolution in Moldavia failed, as the Russian army quickly swooped in to crush the rebels, likely because they had seen what was happening over in Wallachia, and they wanted to make sure to crush this rebellion before the revolutionaries could gain any momentum. Then, after subduing the rebels in Moldavia, the Russian army crossed into Wallachia, and with the help of the Ottomans, they deposed the Romanian nationalist government and appointed a new Wallachian prince, who the Russians and the Ottomans both agreed was a sensible and safe choice. So, like most of the other revolutions that year, the 1848 revolution in Romania ultimately failed because the Russians, acting as the anti-revolutionary police, came in and squashed them. However, the revolution had started rolling the old nationalist boulder down the hill, and specifically, the issue of unifying Wallachia and Moldavia now had so much momentum that it would ultimately prove to be kind of unstoppable. So, you may remember from last time that the Crimean War had actually started when the Russians had invaded the Danubian principalities, and specifically, the Russians had invaded Wallachia. Well, once the Russians lost the Crimean War, they were forced to remove all of their troops from the Danubian principalities. And as a result, the Romanians were given a greater amount of autonomy and self-control over their government. It was also decided during the peace talks that there would be some sort of referendum down the road that would allow a certain amount of popular sovereignty, with the Romanian people ultimately deciding the fate of their provinces and whether or not they should be joined. But this was a fragile issue within great power politics, and so it kept getting kicked down the road, until in 1859, the Romanians decided to take things into their own hands. That year, the great powers had allowed for new elections to be held in both Wallachia and Moldavia, though it is important to note that these elections were meant to be separate events. This is important because the elections brought about a pretty unexpected result when both Moldavia and Wallachia elected the same man to be their prince, a man named Alexander Kuza, who had actually taken part in the Moldavian Revolution of 1848 and had since then been a strong advocate for unification. So, even though the great powers had been trying their darndest to put off indefinitely the issue of Romanian unification, Prince Kuza was now the leader of both Moldavia and Wallachia, and for all intents and purposes, Romanian unification had been achieved. There would be a brief period of political limbo, but everything became official in 1862, when Kuza was proclaimed Prince Regent of a now united Romania. So that's right, folks, we will no longer be talking about the all-important Danubian principalities, but we will instead be talking about Romania. And even though this brand spanking new Romanian nation was still technically a principality under Ottoman suzerainty, this was the lightest possible suzerainty, and much like their neighbors over in Serbia, Romania was for all intents and purposes completely autonomous, and it was really only a matter of time until official independence would be recognized. So, in 1863, when Georgi Rukovski was settling into his life of exile in Bucharest, the bustling capital of the newly united Romania, he was joining a cosmopolitan and Western-facing community chock full of people excited about ideas like national self-determination and republicanism and revolutionary liberation. And indeed, Bucharest was often called the Paris of the Balkans due to the influence of French architecture on the city's buildings and the influence of French revolutionary ideas amongst the city's residents. So, while in Bucharest, Rakovsky continued his relentless pursuit of Bulgarian national liberation by distributing pamphlets, publishing newspapers, and just generally working to build a community of Bulgarian revolutionary immigrants in Bucharest who would meet and plan and discuss the best course of action for achieving Bulgarian independence. Perhaps most significantly, though, Rakovsky began during this time to put together small bands of revolutionary fighters known as Cheti. Now fully convinced that independence could only be achieved through a violent armed struggle, Rakovsky organized armed Cheti war bands to be sent on revolutionary missions into the heart of Bulgaria. On several different occasions throughout the late 1860s, these Cheti would enter into Bulgaria and incite unrest and rebellion, always with the hope of sparking a broader revolt amongst the population as a whole, or better yet, sparking international intervention on their behalf. Almost as a rule, though, these Cheti uprisings would quickly be squashed by the much more powerful Ottoman Imperial Army. So, at least in the short term, these little adventures primarily led to the deaths of many young, promising Bulgarian revolutionaries and brought about very few tangible results. However, Rokovsky's efforts to organize these armed Cheti would become important in creating links of solidarity amongst Bulgarian revolutionaries from different walks of life. At first, many of the revolutionary fighters organized under Rokovsky's leadership in Bucharest came out of the ranks of the old Bulgarian Legion, whose members had been forced to leave Serbia much like Rokovsky. But now, Rakovsky was beginning to make more and more connections within Bulgaria itself, especially amongst the leaders of the armed Hajduk bands, the Robin Hood-esque bandits who had inspired Rakovsky's poems some 10 years earlier. As Rakovsky made connections with Hajduk leaders, known as the Voivodi, he worked hard to direct their efforts more and more towards coordinated revolutionary action as opposed to sporadic armed robbery of Ottoman officials. And one of the most important of these Hajduk leaders was a man named Paniot Hitov, who would become legendary not only as a fierce revolutionary Voivodi, but also for his mustache, which was even more epic than Rakovsky's mustache. And that is saying something. I mean, Hitov's mustache extended like half a foot beyond his face in both directions. That is not a guy you want to mess with. As Rakovsky built his revolutionary network from his home base in Bucharest, he would correspond with Hitov for several years, with Hitov providing an anchor for Rakovsky amongst the Hajduks, and Rakovsky helping to transform Hitov from being a mountain bandit to being a full-blown revolutionary. This budding relationship would culminate in 1867, when Rakovsky made an official proclamation to his revolutionary agents, in which he named Hitov as the chief voivode, pointing to Hitov's growing importance amongst the revolutionary Haiduks in Bulgaria. Through fostering connections such as these, both inside and outside of Bulgaria, Rakovsky had, by 1867, successfully constructed the skeleton of a Bulgarian revolutionary network based in Bucharest. And this network had begun to include Bulgarian revolutionaries from a broader swath of society, including educated middle-class intellectuals such as Rakovsky himself, as well as battle-tested Haiduks from the Bulgarian hinterlands, like Panayot Hitov. But sadly, Rakovsky's work would have to be carried on by future revolutionaries, because his life would tragically be cut short in October of 1867, when he died of tuberculosis. Georgi Rakovsky had been tirelessly pushing for Bulgarian national liberation for some 30 years, and towards the end of his life, his efforts had finally begun to bear fruit, as his revolutionary network of émigrés and Haiduks was finally beginning to grow in size and influence. And shortly before Rakovsky's untimely death, the revolutionary leader would make a fateful recommendation to his mustachioed Haiduk friend, Panayot Hitov. While in Belgrade, Rakovsky had been impressed by an energetic young man named Vasil Levski, who had served under him in the Bulgarian Legion. And Rakovsky would select Levski as the standard-bearer of Panayot Hitov's Cheti warband. And though he was just now making a name for himself, it would be Vasil Levski, more than anyone else, who would carry on the work of Georgi Rakovsky, as Levski continued to build a network of Bulgarian revolutionaries across the Balkans, and even more importantly, within Bulgaria itself. So, next week we will see Rakovsky's legacy live on through Vasil Levski and his revolutionary compatriots as they form the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee, an organization whose efforts will spark numerous uprisings throughout Bulgaria and ultimately create the conditions for the liberation of the Bulgarian nation, and in the process, bring the Ottoman Empire yet again to the brink of collapse.